06-5421 et al. Gail G. Billington versus Department of Justice, appellant. Mr. Bonner, Lyons for the appellant, Bussar for the appellate.
Good morning. Jane Lyons for the U.S. Attorney's Office for Department of Justice, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case is about protecting the substantial privacy interests of a private citizen who voluntarily and without being solicited provided information to the government, where there's no public interest served by the disclosure of that information under the Freedom of Information Act. In the cross appeal, there's also the question of the identity of an informant who provided information based on an express grant of confidentiality. At least in my opening argument, I'd like to address the private citizen rather than the confidential source, but I'll obviously answer any questions you may have. To get oriented, there are essentially three documents that are still at issue in this case, and this case has been on appeal in this court before. The main document is a document called Notes on Interview throughout the record. These are notes submitted by a private person of the State Department, and the State Department provided the document to the FBI. The district court ordered it released with redactions that the district court made after it examined the document in camera and after it had the benefit of a declaration provided by the Department of Justice about the document. Now, there's some considerable information in the record in the underseal portion of the joint appendix about these notes. And I refer the court to the joint appendix under seal at pages 4 through 6, really 8, for this information. But what Ms. Billington knows about the notes on interview are the date the interview took place, the length of the document that we're talking about, where the interview took place, the purpose of the interview, and some of the content or tone of the document. What's significant about the date, which you can find on the joint appendix under seal portion at page 4, is that it's actually at a point in time before the National Caucus of Labor Committees gave up their violent agenda and turned to a more political-minded group. And that's significant because it plays into the privacy interests and also the public interests that are at stake in the Exemption 6 balancing. With regard to those, the person who wrote these notes of an interview have a substantial and overwhelming privacy interest. His private thoughts and impressions are included in the document, and the risk here is that its disclosure could ultimately allow his identity to be uncovered. But beyond his identity, there's also his mental and emotional privacy, which is at stake if he knows that the document has been released.
How much weight do you put on the assurance of confidentiality that was provided here?
For the notes in the interview, there isn't really an express assurance of confidentiality. What we have in the record, in the declaration from the interviewer, is his understanding that he provided them with the expectation that it would be. Not so much an assurance, but an expectation that his information would be kept confidential.
Are you arguing from the perspective of releasing the notes on interview without redactions as opposed to releasing them with the judge's redactions?
We are challenging the release at all. The government's position is there should be no release of the notes on interview themselves. Under the unique circumstances of this case, and particularly in light of how much information about them has already been disclosed, This is a...
Because a good many of your arguments, I think, seem to me to fall quite flat when you're talking when you're talking about the redacted document as opposed to the one without redactions. I mean, the whole business of his private mental processes and thoughts, really, it's hard to see after all the redactions that were made why the redacted document reflects that.
I think it goes to the record of not only what would be released through the unredacted portions of it, but also the information that's been released through the litigation that makes the chances of identification real and substantial in this case.
Well, identification is one thing. Let's just put that aside for the moment. You're talking about the privacy interests of his mental processes. Where in the redacted document can you tweak out the internal, you know, all that stuff, all the parentheticals, all the rest of the stuff was redacted?
It goes, the mental and emotional privacy that I'm speaking about is related to the identity issue. It's not so much that it grows out of the text
That's
of the interview itself.
Maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you were presenting the argument that by releasing this document, it reveals his mental processes.
That is part of our argument, Your Honor. It's both. It's both that the release itself gives a window into how he thought and how he wrote, reacted to things. And then the other side of that is that his knowledge that that information has been released and could lead to his identification disturbs him in a different way. Those are interests that are a little more recognized in the Favish decision from the Supreme Court than some of the previous case law. But there can be no doubt that the privacy interests here are substantial. And then the question becomes under Exemption 6 whether there's anything on the public interest side.
I think there is doubt that the privacy interest is substantial, but you go on. So you said there can't be any doubt. I think there is. Taking a look at it, the redacted document seems to me to be quite bland.
Given that the release of information in terms of the date and the location of the interview and all the other information that's in the record makes identification of the interviewer relatively easy. In fact, Ms. Billington has speculated about the identity of individuals.
If I put aside the previous opinions in this case, but the fact that a journalist interviewed a bunch of people during this period of time, is that a private fact?
The interview itself is a private matter. It's only two people who were interviewed who are the subject of this particular notes on interview document.
Well, how does that make it private, then?
It's a private transaction between non-governmental entities.
But it becomes not private when the journalist turns it over to the government.
It becomes something that's...
Especially without an assurance of confidentiality.
There's no assurance, but there is an expectation under the circumstances, and the district court had information...
Well, the journalist certainly would be experienced in asking for an assurance of confidentiality.
I don't think there's anything in the record that addresses the level of sophistication of the journalist with regard to dealing with the government.
Why does he give it to the State Department?
I can't answer that from any information on the record, Judge Randolph. I don't know why the State Department is what he thought. Maybe that goes to Judge Kavanaugh's question about the level of sophistication of this person. I don't know.
Well, maybe he had a friend in the State Department that he gave it to because he knew it would get widely disseminated through his friend, and he didn't know who to give it to at Justice or any of the other places.
Once again, now we're just speculating outside the record, which is all we're left to do. But the privacy interest doesn't contribute significantly
to... Well, there's
to
no
that.
Evidence, is there, or no suggestion that when the State Department then forwarded it to the Department of Justice, they were violating any assurance to the journalist?
There's nothing in the record that suggests that, no.
And the document itself is filled with initials, which indicates that it went through a lot of different hands.
You mean the handwritten things that had been added to the document since the journalist submitted it?
Right.
As a result of the FBI's filing, I think it probably tells you more about the FBI's pack rat mentality and how they go about filing things than anything else. But the release
I reflect back when I went back to the Department of Justice after having left. In the interim, I had argued a case for Senator Eastland, who was chairman of the Judiciary Committee, And he sent me a letter, a thank you letter. It took about 2 months for that letter to get to me because it was intercepted at the Department of Justice, and every single high official that I can think of initialed it for me. I mean, it was my private letter. So I see that, and I know from experience what's happening here is this document's going through one hand after another, and each person that sees it initials. So it doesn't sound real private to me.
It's at that point running through the FBI's process from coming in from the outside to being filed. At most, it doesn't reflect government activity above a ministerial level. To the extent that this interview, any information contained in the notes, led to FBI activity, that is the subject of documents that have been released through the FOIA requests otherwise. We're very focused here on one case, but I would submit that hundreds of other documents that have been released better demonstrate what the government was up to, which is supposed to be what core purpose of FOIA is supposed to serve.
I thought most of the case law, and you cite a few cases, suggests that when people write into the government generally or submit information to the government, that information is not protected from FOIA disclosure. Their names, addresses, that kind of identifying information can be protected, but the substance, for example, of a letter you send in is not ordinarily protected under the case law. Am I reading the case law correctly?
I think you're reading the case law correctly. I think our argument here is slightly different. And our argument here is that this is not a run-of-the-mill routine submission because it involves activities that the author or the interviewer characterizes at times in derogatory ways, and it's provided to the government.
I thought your primary argument was that the substance of the information could connect the dots to the lead the person to know the identity, to figure out identities. Is that not accurate?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. I'm not trying to shift that argument.
Okay.
I'm trying to explain a facet of it. This is maybe a typical situation at the beginning when the document is handed over. I don't think it's violating the seal to say that the interview takes place in the 1970s. This lawsuit is filed in 1992 as a result of 1991 and 1992 FOIA requests made by Ms. Billington. There's a long period of time there during which the court has to look at this whole situation. And the whole situation includes a lot of information that make this, when the decision is made by the FBI whether to release, a different situation than just it was information sent into the government. The nature of the information, the nature of the organization, the fact that it did become part of the FBI's law enforcement investigatory file are all facts that bear on this decision. It's not a situation where you can just look at it as one thing. The single fact that it was submitted to the government is one fact among many that have to be looked at in the Exemption 6 analysis. And those, one of the things that you look at in that situation, I think, is on the public interest side, the idea under FOIA is for disclosure to serve the public interest. And there is a certain public interest in the government being able to receive information from the public and not have to disclose it if there are circumstances, as here, where disclosure risks the identification of someone who had an expectation of being not revealed. So our position is that
That's the test. Someone who discloses something to the government, that should not be released if there's a risk in identification from release of the substance of the material.
It goes beyond just a risk of identification, perhaps, to a real and genuine threat, which is something that that the district court had no trouble concluding here based on the organization and the facts in the record that illuminate why there's a danger to this person through his identification.
You really got most of what you really wanted in the district court, didn't you?
I would submit that Judge Lamberth, and very respectfully, Judge Lamberth did a good job. We believe he didn't go far enough in preserving the identity of the journalist in view of all of the facts in the situation in this case. But the district court did do a responsible job by reviewing the material in camera and doing what he thought was a responsible job. He didn't go far enough under all the circumstances.
You're into your rebuttal time.
I know, and I don't want to eat it all up, so I think I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Hear from the appellee, cross appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. James H. Lassar, representing Gail Billington.
Have you come late to the fair, or have you got any new trials this evening?
Well, I was, the last time this case was before this court, I was brought in to handle the oral argument.
Seemed to me I had seen you before.
Yes, right. But it's been limited to that, and I must say it's a daunting to go over the extensive record here and come to grips with everything. I wanted to, excuse me one second. I wanted to begin first by addressing the issue of whether or not the district court abused its discretion in granting the motion for the department's motion for reconsideration under 60B6. We think that it's quite clear that there was an abuse of discretion there. That motion must be made within a reasonable time, and in this case, and that the cases have indicated that that is usually tied to there are several factors in determining what is a reasonable time, but a key element is when the party making the motion is placed on notice that it faces an adverse decision unless it takes some action. In this case, as early as 1998, the department was on notice that its Exemption 6 argument was not being accepted, and its Exemption 7D argument likewise. And certainly by December of 2001, when this court remanded and indicated very strongly in its opinion that the government's showing did not pass muster, at that point it was incumbent upon the government to
We indicated very strongly.
You indicated that the government's showing with respect to the Exemption 6 and 7D claims was insufficient. And
our prior decision was procedural. It concerned the
It contains language in it saying that that you are remanding for the government to make a stronger showing with respect to those exemptions if it can. And I'm talking about the 2003 decision. This 2001 decision. The prior decision, which was last year, was procedural. But at any rate,
you can't sell the cases without a scorecard.
That's for sure.
It's a 2001 decision?
2000, I think.
2000, yes, December 2000. They certainly knew at that point that they needed to produce additional information to sustain the claims, and they didn't do so for nearly another 2.5 years. The policy undergirding the reasonable time limitation of Rule 60B6 is based in part on the principle of finality. And this court has said in the August v. FBI case that that is particularly strong force in the context of FOIA actions.
I think you must. The standard of review here is
Abuse of discretion, yes. We did. Mm-hmm. I conceded that. I began that
anything
way.
Anything in particular, I don't want to be as atomistic as we discussed in the last case, but anything in particular that makes the district judge's actions in this case an abuse of discretion given the lax standard that we're applying?
Well, I think that it's an abuse of discretion, first because of the it should not have been granted under the lack of timeliness principle. Secondly,
it's not a set time; it's a reasonable time.
It's a reasonable time, but it was clearly unreasonable.
Time had passed between the entry of and the 60B.
The entry of the.
What is the lapse of time that you're saying was unreasonable?
Well, two years, 5 months.
How does that become the measuring standard?
Pardon?
How does that become the measuring standard?
Well, because at that point they were placed on notice that there was something deficient in their submissions, and they needed to come forward with the evidence or not, and they didn't do so for.
What's the time between the judgment being modified under the 60B and the entry of the, and the moving of the 60B?
Well, the judgment of this court was
December. Not this court. He wasn't trying to modify our judgment.
Pardon?
The district court's judgment, the 60B, was made with reference to, right?
That's correct.
I have it right. Under the district court entered a judgment.
Right.
The government moved for a 60B, under 60B.
That's correct. It did.
What's the lapse of time between that entry and that motion?
I'm not sure. That was much shorter.
Yeah.
That period was much shorter.
That's the time we have to look to, isn't it?
Well, I don't think so. I think that you look to.
I'm not sure how we could write a rule, an opinion, a presidential opinion that would say we would look to anything else to measure the interval for the reasonableness of a 60B, other than the time from entry of judgment to the time of the making of the motion. What kind of precedent?
Well, there had been a prior judgment. There had been a judgment in 1998.
There have been all kinds of prior things in this case. Facts. We're writing a presidential opinion, presumably. I'm not sure how you think we should write this opinion.
In 1998, the district court judge had rejected the evidentiary showing made by the Department of Justice. The time to make the 60B motion was then. It didn't make it until 5 years later.
The judgment doesn't exist anymore, right?
Pardon?
That's been up here twice and set aside. And you have a 60B motion with reference to the entry of a particular judgment. Can you tell me how we would write an opinion that would look to any date to begin the computation of reasonable time other than the entry of that judgment? How would you like us to write that opinion? That we look to the judgment? See what the judge did 5 years earlier?
Well, I think that is indeed relevant. It's relevant to the policy of finality. It's relevant to
how should I phrase that judgment if I that sentence if I'm writing the opinion or one of my colleagues? How should we phrase that?
That the Department of Justice did not timely call this evidence to the attention of the court after it was on notice that its showing was deficient.
You know what the time interval is between the judgment and the motion, and you're telling me we're supposed to under.
No, but I'm arguing.
It's unreasonable. You can't even tell me what it is.
Well, but I'm not arguing. I did tell you when the first judgment was. It's 1998.
Yeah, and I told you that's not what we're timing from. Time from when you got a 60B motion, you look to the underlying judgment, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, that underlying judgment was entered after the case had been up here a few times.
Okay. Let me think the government must also show under 60B that there were extraordinary circumstances, and it has not done that. This case does not present extraordinary circumstances. The issue, in some respects, is very similar to that in the MADAC case.
The MADAC was where the government had failed to raise. Failed is too nice a word. Where the government played that sandbagging tactic that they used to play, where they would assert one exemption fight it all the way through the Court of Appeals, lose.
Right.
Goes back down.
Right.
Yes, sir. Another example.
Right.
Fight that
right.
all the way through the Court of Appeals, lose. Goes
right.
back down. Yes,
right.
sir. The third.
And that's
you
that's.
Doing that. If you got three exemptions, just start them all at once.
That's right.
Not parallel to anything that happened here.
Well, it is parallel to it because what they're doing is the same thing, although instead it's not being inserted in terms of a claim. An exemption claim, it's being done in terms of presentation of evidence. You present the minimal amount of evidence you have, not the strongest case you have. You lose on that, you get remanded on that, then you come back in with more evidence. Basically the same thing's going on. Basically the same thing is at issue. And in MADAC, the fact that the ruling would result in the disclosure of information regarding third parties was not considered sufficiently an extraordinary circumstance to invalidate the action the court took there, and it shouldn't be in this case either. In fact, in MADAC, it was the disclosure was wholesale disclosure. Here we're just talking about three documents. So the court abused its discretion under those circumstances in granting the government's motion on that principle. Now, the government's case with respect to the decision that the court had made, in which it considered the in-camera affidavits without making available to the plaintiff the materials that the government's explanation, which he ordered, ultimately ordered that should be made available, but it wasn't made available, hasn't still been made available, and plaintiff didn't have any opportunity to contest the in-camera submissions that were being made, and the court simply adopted the view of the journalist rather than looking at the case objectively and hearing both sides on that matter. The government maintains in this case that there's no public interest in disclosure, and it maintains, in fact, in some points in its brief, in its opening brief, it says that in fact there was no government activity here. There's no government document here is essentially what they're arguing. If that were true, there wouldn't be a FOIA action. There's obviously a government action, a government activity in operations, and we've learned...
There's a difference between information created by the government and information submitted to the government. So as a matter of first principles,
Submitted by private parties can certainly become government records.
I understand that, but you said there's no FOIA action.
Right. No, but you take the extreme position that they argue, they're not government records, you know. But in fact, they are, and we've learned this morning one of the details that we should have had so we could oppose the government's motions below. We've learned that the documents reflect having been viewed by a number of government officials. That certainly indicates that they were part of government operations and activities, and that the government in this case, in order to reverse Judge Lambert's decision on the Exemption 6 issue, they've got to show that there were clearly erroneous factual findings or some legal error, and they haven't done so. He made very carefully laid out factual findings, and they go to the heart of the issue. He says that the information that will be revealed goes to the core purpose of the FOIA. It reveals the operations and activities of the government, and it does so.
At the threshold, isn't it problematic for the government to obtain information from private citizens with an expectation of confidentiality and then turn around and publicly disclose it? I mean, under the FOIA? I mean, isn't that a, I'm not sure how that squares with exemption six necessarily, but that seems something of concern.
I'm sorry.
They wouldn't have the information to begin with, but for the expectation of confidentiality that the submitting party had.
Well, we have no evidence on the record, so far as the plaintiffs are, that the journalist had that expectation.
Well, the district court judge said as much, and you've.
He says that, but we don't know. There are all kinds of things that he says that we don't know about. For example, it's being presumed here that that the journalist had a great privacy interest. That to me seems counter to his description as a senior editor at a magazine who's got an interview with State Department officials. And insofar as he's interviewing the two NCLC members as well, his expectation, I would assume, would be that he's going to use that for publication. Indeed, the comments that he writes might well have been intended for publication. That's the kind of counter-argument that we might be able to make if we had been allowed access to an explanation of the in-camera affidavits, but we don't have that, so we don't know and haven't been able to raise those questions properly. I think that in terms of the large part of the government's argument is that by disclosing...
Can I interrupt you? Do I remember correctly that the district judge, after making his 60B ruling, ordered that the government release at least some of the in-camera submissions?
Yes, that's correct. He did.
Did you get to see?
Well, we haven't seen any. We haven't seen a thing. We haven't seen a thing. What I was going to address was this question of the fact that the government argues that if you disclose the names of the two NCLC members, that the LaRouche organization today would be able to determine the identity of the journalists. In fact, they even argue that the comments would enable them to do that. That's based on a characterization of the LaRouche, the NCLC as a small group, but that is not the fact. This is a group of many hundreds of people, and it has changed over time. The membership today is not what it was then.
If my colleagues have no further questions, your time is up.
All right, fine. I'll submit the case.
How much rebuttal time is there?
1 minute, 21 seconds.
Round it up to 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm not sure I'll need it all. If it would be helpful, I'd be happy to provide the dates between the entry of judgment and the government's 60B6 motions. I have a couple comments on that. First of all, you can't file a 60B6 motion or any motion under 60B until you have a judgment, as you pointed out, Judge Sentell. The two that I know that are at issue here are a result of, first, the February 14, 2003 order, which the government filed a notice of appeal on April 15th, and then it filed its motion for reconsideration and request for leave to submit in-camera submissions on April 28th. So it's about 60 days to the notice of appeal, and then the government decided to come back in and try to persuade Judge Lamberth to do the right thing first.
Is that the one that washed out in the procedural decision, or is that the one?
The timing of the notices of appeal and then the subsequent motions for reconsideration is what tripped us last time. The second order that the judge entered was February 4th, 2004.
Once the notice of appeal is filed, the district court loses jurisdiction.
Right.
Is that the idea?
That's what happened last time,
that's why
we're back.
Now, on this one, you had a new judgment and a new 60B, didn't you?
Well, what happened this time was the district court re-entered its previous orders unchanged.
What date did he re-enter?
What date did they get re-entered?
Mm-hmm.
That's not the time from which you need to measure the 60B question. The 60B issue that we're talking about following.
The same 60B motion from last time.
Yes, exactly.
That's 60 days
So there's 60 days to the notice of appeal, and then about another 2 weeks to the 60.
How long between the entry of the judgment and the entry of the order and the 60B motion?
About 2.5 months.
Okay, thank you.
And the interesting thing to note in both cases, there's a February 4th order as well, and a 60B motion is filed after that as well. And Ms. Billington also filed 60B motions after the government filed its 60B motions in both cases, and yet she's complaining that it was unreasonable for the district court and an abuse of discretion to take
For Exemption 6 purposes, do you agree there's a distinction between an expectation of confidentiality and an assurance of confidentiality?
I agree that there's a difference between those two things. The precise difference matters much more in the context of a 7D analysis, where the assurance of confidentiality is all that matters. In the Exemption 6 context, it's different, and the expectation of privacy is significant.
So
it doesn't carry the day.
The subjective expectations of the submitting party? That would seem to present a host of difficult questions in cases involving requests for documents that were submitted to the government.
I think that may be true, but I think that it's important to recognize that this is a law enforcement context that we're dealing with here.
Okay, but it's not 7D, so
true.
It kind of drops out.
It drops out in terms of it being an absolute slam dunk, but it is important in the context of the expectation of the person submitting it.
I mean, lots of people might write in letters to the government, to the executive branch, and expect confidentiality and have no assurance. And is the FOIA analysis supposed to vary in each case, depending on whether the person sending in the letter thought, no, this will never be released?
I think
that's your position, which I think presents a host of problems for future cases.
I think it depends on a case-by-case analysis of the facts.
Yeah, that's what I mean, and that's going to be a host of problems for...
Well, I think that this case presents a situation where we've got the substantial privacy interest and the expectation of privacy and confidentiality.
I mean, it can't be enough just to have the expectation of privacy. I wouldn't
think. Right. But on the other hand, if you look at just the marginal public interest that would be served by the release of this particular document, which is, I think, how you have to do it, you have to do it on a document-by-document basis within the context of a large FOIA request and a large file. And on that, when you get to the end of that level, the marginal public interest served by this disclosure is far outweighed by the substantial and compelling privacy interests of the third parties. All of them, all three. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Case is submitted.